For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Lord, thank you that you are a God of truth. Thanks, God, that you reveal truth to us, that you make truth known to us. This is something that we want to share with the people we care about, God. And so pray you'd help us grow in our ability to communicate the stuff we're learning this week in a way that draws people close to you. Amen. All right, so like I said, we're going to be talking about apologetics and evangelism. And so just to give some clarity on what this workshop is going to be like, think about it like an NFL playbook. So in an NFL game, there's about 60 offensive plays per team, right? And in any given playbook, you might have anywhere up to 150 plays. Now, obviously, you're not going to use every single play every single game. And so, you know, the workshops that you guys have been attending, each of these lines of evidence that you've been learning more about act as an individual play, right? I'm going to move this chair. It's kind of in the way. Anyway, so you've been learning about these different lines of evidence that act as a play. The thing is, you need to also know, you know, when is it appropriate to use certain lines of evidence? When, just like in the NFL, you know, I'm not going to use every play every single time. I need to learn how do I use it? When do I use it? Why do I use it? And so that's the game plan. It's understanding what do I do with this information that I've now learned. And so that's what the goal of this workshop is. It's to create a game plan for how we can use the information we're learning here in our efforts to share our faith with people. So we're going to talk about, one, what are apologetics? Why use apologetics in evangelism? So why would we use this when sharing our faith? And finally, we'll talk about how we can use apologetics as we're sharing our faith with other people. So let's just go into it. What are apologetics? So apologetics comes from the Greek word apologia, which just means a defense of one's conduct or opinions. It's a legal term. And we see this come up several points in the New Testament. In Acts 22, when Paul is speaking to his Jewish accusers in Jerusalem, he says, "Brothers and fathers, listen now to my defense. Listen to my apologia." And so Paul goes on to share his experience meeting the risen Jesus on the road to Damascus. That's his defense, his apologia. Romans 1:20, "For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse." This word without excuse is anapologetos, literally means without a defense. So it's, you know, whereas apology is to have a defense, this is to be without a defense. And so we see the inverse, that, you know, Paul is describing from nature, we can learn about God and who he is. And because of that, we are left without a defense. Philippians 1, Paul says, "Both in my imprisonment and in the defense and confirmation of the gospel, you all are partakers of grace with me. The latter do it out of love, knowing that I am appointed for the defense of the gospel." Again, that same word, apologia. Paul viewed himself and his role as an apostle as someone who was a defender, who gave a defense for the faith, defense for Christianity. And then in 1 Peter 3:15, Peter says, "Sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence." And so Peter says you need to be ready for an apologia, to make a defense. This is not something that he just calls on a few people to do or a select group of individuals, but it's to everyone in the church needs to be ready to make a defense for the hope that they have in a way that is gentle and reverent. And so we see both the command for all people, but also the manner in which it happens with gentleness and reverence. And so properly understood, apologetics are just the rational defense of the Christian faith. You know, as we go on, we're going to see that this was the normative experience of the early church, that as you see the gospel move forth from Jerusalem to the ends of the earth, as, you know, past Jerusalem, past Judea, past the ancient world, we see that as people are sharing their faith and reaching different communities, apologetics plays a key role in that, that this comes alongside people's efforts to share their faith. So the next question is, why would we use apologetics in evangelism? So why is it that we need to do this as we're sharing our faith with people? Well, as I mentioned, this is the pattern of the New Testament. We just covered a handful of verses, but there are way more. We can start with Jesus himself arguing with his opponents. We go through and look at the book of Acts and the experience of the early church, but also, as we just saw, letters in the New Testament that call on all believers to defend their faith. So let's look at Jesus for a second. In Matthew 12, it says, "Then a demon-possessed man who was blind and mute was brought to Jesus, and he healed him, so that the mute man spoke and saw. All the crowds were amazed and were saying, "This man cannot be the son of David, can he?" But when the Pharisees heard this, they said, "This man casts out demons only by Beelzebul, the ruler of the demons." And so they're like, you know, Jesus heals this man. People look at this and they're like, this is the Messiah. You know, who can do this other than the Messiah? And yet the opponents of Jesus say, he's demon possessed. That's why he's casting out demons, is because he does this by the power of Satan. And so it's a little confusing to make this claim that the reason why Jesus is able to perform these kinds of miracles is because he's possessed by Satan. And so what does Jesus say about this specific claim? It says, knowing their thoughts, Jesus said to them, any kingdom divided against itself is laid waste, and any city or house divided against itself will not stand. If Satan casts out Satan, he is divided against himself. How then will his kingdom stand? If I, by Beelzebul, cast out demons, by whom do your sons cast them out? For this reason they will be your judges. But if I cast out demons by the Spirit of God, then the kingdom of God has come upon you. Do you notice the argument that Jesus is making here? He begins with the Pharisees' premise that he's driving out demons by the power of Satan. He's like, okay, let's think about that. What kingdom works where people are working against each other? What happens is those kingdoms fail. They divide against each other and they destroy themselves. So he says, why would you think that I'm being empowered by Satan if I'm casting out demons? That's absurd. And so he goes on to say, there's other people casting out demons and you say they're from God. So why do you think I'm doing it by Satan? So again, Jesus points out, your argument is absurd. It does not make sense. And we see this kind of reasoning come from Jesus several points in the New Testament. But we go on later in Matthew 22 and see a similar type of exchange between Jesus and his opponents. It says, on that day, some Sadducees, who say there is no resurrection, came to Jesus and questioned him, asking, teacher, Moses said, if a man dies having no children, his brother as next of kin shall marry his wife and raise up children for his brother. Now there were seven brothers with us, and the first married and died, and having no children, left his wife to his brother. And so also the second, and the third, all the way down to the seventh. Last of all, the woman died. In the resurrection, therefore, whose wife of the seven will she be? For they all had married her. And so the Sadducees are like, we came up with this. They don't believe in the resurrection, as it says in the scriptures. But it says, you know, this is so absurd that there's such thing as a resurrection. Let's come up with this grand scheme to trap Jesus. Like, think of how absurd the situation is. You know, if there's a resurrection, who's she going to be married to? Not all seven. And so they think, we got Jesus on this trap right here. There's no way he's going to be able to answer this question. So how does he respond? Jesus answered them and said to them, you are mistaken, not understanding the scriptures nor the power of God. For in the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels in heaven. But regarding the resurrection of the dead, have you not read what was spoken to you by God? I am the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but of the living. When the crowds heard this, they were astonished at his teaching. So Jesus says, you don't understand the scriptures. And so what he does is he pulls open the scriptures and he says, let's reason from what the Old Testament actually has to say about this. You say you don't believe in a resurrection. Let's see what it says. That God, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And that because God is the God of the living, we know that there is a resurrection. And so Jesus, from the scriptures, reasons with his opponents. And it says the crowds heard this and they were astonished. You know, there are a lot of reasons why in Jesus' day people were drawn to Jesus. One of the main things is that people heard his teaching, the way he refuted his opponents, and they were drawn to that. There was power to his teaching. And so Jesus was not foreign to using sound argument to defend his claims about himself. How about the risen Jesus in Luke 24? It says, was it not necessary for the Christ to suffer these things and to enter into his glory? Then beginning with Moses and with all the prophets, he, Jesus, explained to them the things concerning himself in all the scriptures. And so he shows up with these two guys on this road to Emmaus, and he says, didn't you know that this is talking about Jesus? This guy Jesus that you're talking about? And so he reasons through the entire Old Testament, the law and the prophets, to explain why they were pointing to Jesus. Can you imagine Jesus reasoning through the Old Testament, explaining to you why it points to him? That'd be pretty cool. And yet they got to experience that. And Jesus made a point to reason with them from the scriptures why it was talking about him. So, you know, as you're reading through the Gospels, comb through and notice how Jesus explains who he is. From argument, from the scriptures. This was very common that Jesus did this. And we also see this in the example of the New Testament church. When Paul was in Thessalonica, it says he went to them for three Sabbaths and reasoned with them from the scriptures, explaining and giving evidence that the Christ had to suffer and rise again from the dead, saying, "This Jesus who I'm proclaiming to you is the Christ." And so in Thessalonica, Paul meets with the people, reasons from the scriptures, saying, "This is why the person I'm talking to you in the scriptures is Jesus." And so we see him making arguments for Jesus with the people. In Acts 18, Paul in Corinth, it says, every Sabbath he reasoned in the synagogue trying to persuade Jews and Greeks. So again, next city, Paul goes in explaining to the people, persuading them on who Jesus is. Later in Acts 18, a different guy, Apollos, is in Achaia, and it says he powerfully refuted the Jews in public, demonstrating by the scriptures that Jesus was the Christ. So we see another figure in the New Testament church going on and explaining who Jesus is from the scriptures. Acts 19, and he entered the synagogue and continued speaking out boldly for 3 months, reasoning and persuading them about the kingdom of God. So Paul's in Ephesus in Acts 19 and explaining to the people for 3 months about who Jesus is, about why it's reasonable to believe in what Jesus did for them. And so we see, again, a pattern here of the early church, people going through and reasoning with people, the plausibility of Christianity. And lastly, we have 2 Corinthians 10:5, letter from Paul. He says, "We are destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God, and we are taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ." It's that we're taking truths with the lowercase t, and examining them to God's truth. You know, is this actually true? How about we look at what God says is true? And we're holding it up to make sure that we actually have what's true here. And, you know, it would be one thing if we looked at one or two examples in the early church of people doing this, but we see littered throughout, this is emphasis here. It's not just one or two examples. It's emphasis of in the times where people are sharing the gospel, where people are participating in the expansion of the church, that apologetics plays a key role. And so, again, we see the pattern of the New Testament when people shared their faith was to involve apologetics. Next point, apologetics can raise people's interest in Christianity. I like the way C.S. Lewis puts this. He says, "Nearly everyone I know that has embraced Christianity in adult life has been influenced by what seemed to him to at least be a probable argument for theism." You know, myself, I did not grow up in a home where my parents were Christians. And so I can definitely relate to this. There's probably a lot of people who accepted Christ at some point where this played a major role in their conversion. Was some sort of argument for a creator, some sort of argument for design, at least getting us to a sense that there is a supernatural. And I love what Lewis is saying here, because the point here is that people's interests can be grown as we talk about this kind of thing. You know, a lot of people don't have a forum to kind of discuss deep topics, you know, other than, you know, how's the weather? Did you see the game last night? When you start to get into questions about people's worldview, as we'll discuss ways to do that later, but as you go into these kind of topics, people actually have lots of thoughts about this. And this is an opportunity for us to engage people on what they think, on what they believe, what drives them, who they are, in a way that we get to know the person, but also opens up new opportunities for spiritual conversations, for conversations about the gospel. You know, the next thing is apologetics and evangelism allows us to lend credibility to the Christian worldview. You know, credibility is very important. I won't say incredibly important. Think about if you're getting an open heart surgery. You wouldn't just let any schmuck carve your chest open and perform that surgery. You would actually want to know, okay, who is the surgeon? How long have they been a surgeon? Have they performed this operation before? Were they successful? How many patients have they seen? Do they work at a reputable hospital? Are they certified? Are they skilled? What's their background, their educational history? Have I met with the surgeon to talk to them? These are all kinds of questions you'd want to get answered before you put, you know, your life in someone else's hands. You know, in the same way, what we're calling for in sharing our faith with people is for them to put their trust in God. And so part of it is we need to create a case that Christianity is reasonable. That it's reasonable for people to put their trust in God, in Jesus. And so, again, it's more than just facts here. It's the more credible, the more trustworthy the case is. And finally, we have an opportunity to remove barriers of faith when we use apologetics as we're sharing our faith. You know, when I was investigating Christianity, I was an atheist. And I remember the biggest problem I had with Christianity was the question of why can we trust the Bible? I had heard people talk about it, and so I had a friend who was a Christian, and I asked him, "Why should I trust that the Bible is from God?" And he answered me, and he said, "The Bible is from God because it says it's from God." And I remember being like, "That is the stupidest thing I've ever heard." And I was like, "Why would I ever believe in something because it says, I could say I'm a car, it doesn't make me a car. Like, why would I believe that the Bible is from God just because it says it is?" And so, it wasn't just that I didn't get the answer to my question, but I left that conversation feeling like, you know what? If I were to ever believe in Christianity, I would have to check my mind at the door. I'd have to believe in something that I know is not real, and I'd essentially have to live a delusion for the rest of my life. And so it wasn't just that, again, not that you don't have an answer to your question, but it creates all these other problems and barriers. And so when we're able to resolve barriers for people, again, it's one less hurdle from people coming to faith. I remember a couple of years later talking to someone as I was more seriously investigating Christianity, and I asked the same question. I was honestly expecting the same answer. And the person said, "That's actually a good question. Why don't do you, would you be interested in looking at some evidence for this?" I said, "Yeah, sure, I'd be down." And then I looked into archaeological evidence of the scriptures. Not only the age of individual manuscripts, but the wealth of manuscripts that we have. I thought that the Bible is just an ancient game of telephone that had been translated many times and mistranslated, and so we could never trust it. I learned that, translation happened once from the original language to the English, and that it wasn't an ancient game of telephone. We can actually track ancient documents, and comparative to other ancient sources, the wealth of information we have is startling. And so it was as I was gathering evidence, it not only built this, Christianity might be more true, it also was, I could actually see myself believing this because it's not just I'm checking my brain at the door, I'm actually learning something here, and I'm getting answers to my questions. And so again, it didn't make me place my faith in Christ because I learned more that the Bible was actually, I had evidence to believe it was from God. But at the same time, it removed a significant hurdle. And that's kind of the place that the opportunity that we have here as we're, sharing our faith with people and we're going and learning these different lines of evidence. You're not making someone receive Christ by sharing these lines of evidence. What you are doing is you are removing significant hurdles for people. And that's what we need to think about. This is why it's important. This could mean the difference for someone thinking Christianity is the stupidest thing they've ever heard, to being at a spot where they decide for themselves, I could actually look into evidence and get answers to my questions. And so this is why we can use apologetics and evangelism. So finally, for the rest of our time, let's just talk about how we can use apologetics and evangelism. You've been sitting through lots of sessions on different lines of reasoning. And so part of what we need to think about is how we can communicate this to people in a way that is, again, gentle and reverent, but also explains what we're learning about. And so the first point we need to make is we need to learn to listen. Might be confusing, I thought we were talking about, sharing our faith. Why do I need to listen to people? And oftentimes, unfortunately, apologetics and listening don't really happen in the same conversation. But we want to change that. We need to make sure that we're learning to listen. The Proverbs have a ton to say about this. Proverbs 18:2, "Fools have no interest in understanding. They only want to air their own opinions." Yeah, I want to tell you all about the things I have to say. I have no interest in hearing what you have to say. Verse 13 says, "Spouting off before listening to the facts is both shameful and foolish." Do we know someone like this? Or are we someone like this? I think when I tend to learn stuff, I tend to be like, oh, I want to just share everything I've learned with people. And part of the temptation on a week like this is we gather up so much good information, so much that could be used for people's benefit, and we take the weight of that stuff and we dump it on people. It's, here's all the arguments for God, and we just, we dump that on people. And it does not have the intended effect. It can actually be alienating. And really, it's showing we're not using wisdom with the things we're learning. It's one skill to learn the information. It's another skill to communicate it to people in a way that's wise and loving. And so that's what we need to understand is how can we communicate these things in a way that's wise and loving. So just to get really practical, one way we can do this is ask questions about people's worldviews. We can ask questions about the things people believe, the things people think, in a way that gets us to understand how they operate. You know, a question like, are you a religious person? Would you consider yourself to be religious? Could be a very easy way to get into a conversation about a person's spiritual beliefs. You could ask, you know, do you believe in God? Do you believe in many gods? What led you to that belief? And at that point, you know, you're not only understanding, you know, what this person believes, but also the way they got to that belief. So again, you're learning more about how this person thinks. Did you grow up going to church? Did you go to synagogue? Did you go to mosque? Did you enjoy it? So again, you're getting people's, their backgrounds, but you're also getting, you know, what's their disposition towards their spiritual beliefs? Maybe they had a terrible church experience and they're telling you about it. Maybe they felt kind of apathetic. They went to church, but they didn't really care. They didn't really learn anything. And so again, it's an opportunity to learn more about the person. What do you think happens when you die? Do you believe in heaven? Do you believe in hell? Do you believe in an afterlife? What are your thoughts on that? You know, this is, again, an opportunity to engage someone on their views beyond this life. But, you know, this doesn't just have to be, like, spiritually, you know, questions have to do with people's spiritual beliefs. You can ask questions that have to do with, you know, even more general things that can get you to conversations that would engage someone on their spiritual beliefs. Would go into a line of, like, discussion where you could actually discuss some apologetics. Think of a question like this. What do you think is the biggest problem people face today? Imagine asking someone that question. I mean, they could have a variety of answers. Someone could say, you know, well, I think, you know, morality in the world is declining. I think that's a huge problem, that we have a big moral issue here, which you could go on to ask. So you believe in morality. Like, how did you come to that belief? Do you think there's a right and a wrong? Do you think that wrong should be judged? Again, lots of questions you could ask based on just asking, what do you think is the biggest problem? Someone might say, well, I think evil and suffering are the biggest problems that people face today. You could ask, you know, do you believe in evil? What's your solution? Do you think there'll ever be justice for some of the suffering and evil that happens in this world? And you can tell, again, you're engaging in conversation that's going to lead to more conversation. Do you think people are basically good? Do you think people are basically bad? You know, if you've ever been in a room with children, this could be a great question to ask another adult. You know, man, that kid is crazy. What do you think? Do you think people are generally good or bad? Do you think we start off good? Do you think we start off bad? Again, a way to engage people on the way they view the world. Do you think life has a purpose? Do you think your life has a purpose? If so, you know, how did you come to that conclusion? What made you think that that is your purpose in life? I like this question. What makes you happy? You know, what's the kind of thing that makes you really enjoy life? What do you think there's something that should make you happy, but maybe doesn't make you happy? And again, the reason why we're doing this is because we're asking people questions to understand them. It's not just intellectual exercise of asking the right questions and X comes out or Y comes out. It's learning about the person. You know, part of this, we're talking about this in the sense of individual people, but we also need to learn to ask these kind of questions about our culture. Conrad did a talk during this week that talked about engaging our culture. I think we need to understand that, you know, there are certain views and beliefs that are absorbed by people in our culture that sometimes they're not aware of, but that as we're talking to people, we learn and begin to understand. That there are common beliefs and values that people hold that we can actually understand as we ask people different questions. And so there is a sense that as we get to talk to people and learn about their worldview, how they think about things, we start to see patterns between people and we start to learn, you know, maybe this is a general thing that our culture promotes. And so there's value to that as we ask questions. If you don't have the book or you've never read Randy Newman's Questioning Evangelism, that'd be a great book to pick up. His emphasis there on asking questions, I think, is phenomenal. It's learning more about the person. You know, and lastly, we need to learn what the person's hang-ups are. We need to see that there are barriers that this person has to coming into a relationship with Christ. There are issues, there are, again, things that are keeping them from even having the conversation of what they think about Jesus. You know, when I went to Brazil a couple summers ago to visit family, and I went to the doctor, got some shots. I got my malaria shot. And then the doctor's like, well, it's not recommended, but if you want to get more shots to, you know, prevent other various diseases, you can. So I said, okay, how many shots are there? Doctor says, well, there's like five or six shots. So I said, you know, I'm good with one hole in my arm. I don't want five or six more. And it's really the impact we have when we barrage people with various lines of evidence that they're not interested in. You know, people have questions that they want answers to. We don't need to overwhelm people with questions that they don't have. Finally, we need to learn to respond. So we talked about the need to listen. We also need to learn how to respond. And that starts with empathizing with people's questions. Think back, you know, think back to a time before you knew Christ where you were investigating Christianity seriously. And if you were very young when you received Christ, think back to a point where you had serious doubts about the existence of God. What kind of place was that like when you were asking those questions? It's probably pretty fragile. And it's a scenario where you want serious questions to be answered. And so we need to think about this when we're talking with people, that their questions, most of the time and oftentimes, people have real doubts and they want real answers to their questions. And so we have an opportunity not only to answer people's questions, but to communicate to them that it is okay to have questions, that this is normal for people to have questions, and I want to engage in dialogue with you on that. You know, think of if you're talking to someone about a pretty difficult subject, you could say something to the effect of, you know, that question really bothered me too. You know, when I was looking into the question of why is there evil, that was something that bothered me for a long time. And yet, you know, someone shared this thing with me and it was actually really helpful if you'd be interested in looking at it. You know, we're pointing out it's normal for someone to feel that way. This is a tough question. And yet I found an answer that I found pretty satisfying and be willing to show you as well. Or something like this along the lines of, you know, there was a long period of time where I also felt pretty unsettled by that. You know, if you've ever gone through any sort of period of doubt in your faith, you probably can empathize with someone's question. You know, there was a long period of time where I really didn't have a good answer to this question. But then this is something someone showed me that helped me understand this very difficult issue. Again, we're communicating to people, you know, that is a hard question. It is difficult. But I did find answers to this. There are answers to this that you can have. You know, how about this? That's a very thoughtful question. Sometimes people will not ask you thoughtful questions. You should not just say every time someone asks you a question, yeah, that's a good question. That's a thoughtful question. But there are going to be times where people ask you questions that are thoughtful, and it's okay to tell them. That's a good question. I was talking to a guy a couple weeks ago who was, he's been investigating Christianity for a while, and he was debating whether or not he wanted to ask God to reveal himself. He wanted to know, you know, should I ask God to show me if you're true? And he was talking to me about it, and he said, you know, the one thing that I'm really worried about is if I do that and there is no God, I'm going to read God into everything that I hear. So I told him, that's a great point. I don't know that I've ever considered that. But then we went on to talk about, you know, well, how about we talk about how does God reveal himself? You know, is this a subjective thing? Is it an objective thing? And we went into a little bit longer conversation about how God wants to reveal himself to people. But it was a good question. It's something I hadn't considered before we talked. And so it's okay to tell people that's a great question. We should encourage people who are giving us honest questions as we're defending our faith. I think a lot of times we might feel frustrated when in reality it's good if people are being honest about their questions or their barriers to faith. You know, again, we've learned different, you know, long arguments or long lines of evidence throughout this conference. And so, you know, you might learn how to defend the design of the creator or discuss, Big Bang cosmology with someone. But in most conversations you have with people, you're not going to be able to talk about all that in 20 seconds, right? And so I thought we could do a little exercise in learning how to give short responses to real questions people have. So I'll put up a question that someone might bring up in conversation, and then maybe just a couple people can answer, raise their hand, how you would respond to a question like that. So say you're talking to a friend, and he or she says, how could a loving God send people to hell? Someone says, you know, how could a loving God send people to hell? You could say, oh, do you believe in hell? Do you believe in an afterlife? Do you believe in heaven? Who do you think goes there? So there's a lot of opportunities there. Again, it's you're not going to be able to roll out the entire argument for, you know, God does not enjoy judging people, that God is rescuing people from judgment, talking about the nature of sin, that people are, you know, inherently deserve judgment, That judgment is loving. You know, who has the right to judge? This is not everything you're going to be able to go into in one conversation. But at the same time, we need to know how can we respond, but also what are the underlying things happening in that question? We kind of talked about it. We need to understand when someone is asking a question like this, part of what's coming up is judgment loving? Who has the right to judge? What is the solution to the problem of evil? And so we need to find, again, quick ways to engage someone in conversation with us. And so a couple of thoughts on how to respond to people. One, you should ask people to offer their explanation. This came up in the last question. But don't take the full burden of proof on yourself. You know, every worldview has to explain why it works. You know, Christianity has an answer to the problem of evil. The person who is a naturalist also has to explain their view on, what is your solution for suffering and human injustice? And so ask people to offer their explanation for their views. Also, be willing to point out inconsistent conclusions in a way that is gentle and loving. You know, you can gently point out a contradiction if you're talking to someone and they say, well, I just don't believe that anything can be true. You could point out, okay, that statement that you're saying claims to be true. So how can it be that, nothing is true if that's true? I'm having a hard time understanding that. You know, pointing out that contradicts itself. Or, my wife was speaking to this guy and his girlfriend, and they were talking about this idea of justice, that can God judge people? And the guy, he's a atheist, a naturalist, and he said, I don't believe in the idea of judgment. I don't think people should be judged. And so she said, okay, well, say your girlfriend was kidnapped and murdered. Do you think that should be judged? His answer was consistent with his worldview, but his girlfriend wasn't very happy about his answer. I mean, it said, do you believe someone like Hitler or someone who's committed, large-scale atrocities should be judged? No, I don't think they should. And so you get someone to a point where, do you understand the absurdity of a statement like that? You know, a lot of the times people haven't put in the thought to see, oh, actually, this aspect of my worldview has problems. And so if we can gently point that out, again, we're not ripping the roofs off people's heads and saying, like, that's a stupid worldview. We're pointing out lovingly and gently that there are issues with the way that you think and believe that I'm interested in hearing your answer to, but I think Christianity actually offers a really good answer to this. And lastly, we need to find out if the person is open-minded. It would be a great shame if you went on an hour conversation about the fine-tuning of the universe and the person didn't care from minute one. What a waste of their time. What a waste of your time. You need to understand. You need to be able to discern or understand, is this person willing to hear, and is this person willing to engage in the conversation? So we need to spend time figuring out, as we're talking, am I picking up on the fact that this person is interested? Am I picking up on the fact that maybe they're not that interested in this conversation? They're kind of shifty. They're looking away. They don't really care. Maybe I shouldn't go on for the next 15 minutes talking about this. Maybe we should cut the conversation. So the last point here on learning to respond is we need to not freak out. It can be easy. You hear other people raise their hands and talk about how they respond, and you say, oh, I could never do that. If I was in conversation, I would just clam up, or I would just rant for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, an hour. It can be pretty intimidating at first as we're learning to share our faith. And at the same time, we need to learn that God is sovereign in this process, that we care about people, but God cares about them way more than we do. And we need to be patient. I have a friend who's been sharing his faith with a guy for 3 years, at different points walking through different lines of evidence. And he's been incredibly patient with this guy. He's not been like, after conversation one, well, this is hopeless, I'm giving up. But he stuck in there with him, prayed for him, and I think that's the kind of posture we need to take. We should not freak out because a conversation doesn't go well or because, maybe this person isn't interested. We need to be patient with people. And so finally, we've talked again. We need to learn to listen. We need to learn to respond. And finally, we need to learn to explain. So we respond to people's questions, but there's also aspects of Christianity that we're going to need to explain to people so that they have an understanding of what the Bible says about Christianity. And this happens alongside sharing the gospel with people. So for one, we're going to need to explain the uniqueness of Christianity. that Jesus claims he's the only way to God, that Christianity is not just a ritualistic religion created by people, that it's not just, you know, what I can do for God, but what God has done for us. We need to point people to predictive prophecy, the fact that Jesus, there are claims about who Jesus would be that he fulfilled, that he couldn't have just faked. You know, part of this, and we'll discuss with some of these, is it would be very helpful to have scripture with you to be able to share with people. You know, share with people Psalm 22 about, you know, Jesus' crucifixion. Share Isaiah 53 with people. Walk through some of that stuff as you're talking about the unique claims of Christianity, that Christianity is unique in predictive prophecy. We're also going to have to explain the idea of grace versus works, that Christianity is not a religion where I earn my way to God, where I become a good enough person for God to accept me, but it's grace. It's that God has given me a free gift. In Ephesians 2, 8, and 9, it's not something we can earn. It's not a wage, but it's a free gift. And so we're going to need to reason with people and explain to people that it's not, Christianity is not about being a good person. It's about receiving a free gift of forgiveness through Christ. We're also going to have to explain what faith is. You know, a lot of people have weird ideas of what faith might be. Someone might think that faith is believing in something despite evidence to the contrary. You know, there's no reason why I should believe this, but faith gives me the power to believe something that's not true. And so we need to point out that biblical faith is not like that. You know, the Bible does not portray faith like that. Hebrews 11 points out that faith is trusting in something you have evidence for, that biblical faith is knowing God is there, and so that there is evidence for believing in who God is. So again, we need to learn to explain faith to people. And finally, we're going to need to learn to explain our personal testimony. You know, it's like in a court case, you have a witness go up to the jury and appear to tell them, you know, this is what I saw, this is what I heard. That's what your opportunity is when you give your testimony. You know, we saw in those passages about Paul, he both reasoned with people, but he also shared his story of encountering Jesus. And you know, both were very persuasive to people. And Paul did these both several times in the book of Acts. And so, you know, we need to think about this in terms of, you know, apologetics is not just a cold exchange of facts. It's relational. This is a conversation between people. You know, people want to see that Christianity works. There is a question of so what? Why does this matter? Okay, so let's say Christianity is true. Let's say all this that you're saying is true. Why should this impact me? Why should this matter at all? And that's the point, is that your testimony is your opportunity to explain to someone how God has actually changed your life. That while it's not the only line of evidence, it is a line of evidence. That this is your opportunity to explain to someone that there is a creator God that wants to know them and wants to engage in their life in a real personal way. And so just some tips on, you know, if you are sharing your personal testimony with someone as you're sharing your faith, for one, keep it short. Don't go on for 20 minutes about your life story, but keep it short. Explain, you know, what you were like before you met Christ, how you met Christ, and how your life has been changed afterwards. You might have a 30-second version of this. You might have a minute-long version, a five-minute. Essentially, you want to have, you know, be able to explain the hope that you have in a way that is easy for people to understand. And again, while it's not the only line of evidence, it can be a powerful one. We see Paul's testimony to the people is persuasive, that people will come to Christ because of this. But again, this happens alongside, you know, helping tear down hurdles for people and explaining the gospel. And so just to finish up, I wanted to share a quote from Francis Schaeffer in his book, He Is There and He Is Not Silent, a great book. But he kind of explains through an analogy this process of someone coming into a relationship with Christ and getting these questions answered and what that's like. And so I wanted to share that. Schaeffer writes, "Suppose we are climbing in the Alps and we are very high on the bare rock and suddenly the fog shuts down. The guide turns to us and says that the ice is forming and that there is no hope. Before morning, we will all freeze to death here on the shoulder of the mountain. Simply to keep us warm, the guide moves us in the dense fog further on the shoulder until none of us have any idea where we are. And suppose we had stopped and we heard a voice which said, 'You cannot hear me, but I know exactly where you are from your voices. I am on another ridge. I have lived here in the mountains, man and boy, for over 60 years, and I know every foot of them. I assure you that 10 feet below you, there is a ledge. If you hang and drop, you can make it through the night, and I will get you in the morning.'" You know, Schaeffer rightly writes, he says, "I would not hang and drop at once, but I would ask questions to try to ascertain if the man knew what he was talking about. He goes on to list some of the questions he would ask. He's like, you know, in the Swiss Alps, there are several families by their last names you would know that they live there. And so that would be reasonable evidence to believe that this guy knows what he's talking about. And so he finishes saying, in my desperate situation, even though time would be running out, I would ask him what would be the sufficient questions. And when I became convinced by his answers, then I would hang and drop. You know, when we're giving people different lines of evidence, this is not the thing that is making people come into a relationship with Christ. But what you're doing is, again, you're giving people the opportunity to make an informed decision. That you're giving people confidence that there is a creator God out there that wants to know them personally. And that's the role we can play as we're sharing our faith, is giving people the evidence to not only make a decision, but to make a decision that they are confident in. So that's all we have.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.